This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
The following recording is of Gifting, a panel discussion held in conjunction with the exhibition and exchange with Saul LeWitt. The discussion featured artists Paul Ramirez Jonas and Sal Randolph and art historian Veronica Roberts, and it was moderated by curator Regine Basha. It took place on March 2, 2011.
My name is Regine Basha, and I'm the curator of this show, although we'll talk about what that is exactly, whether this is in fact a curated show or not, but I conceived of this project. And I am here today with Paul Ramirez Jonas, Veronica Roberts, and Sal Randolph. Just to introduce, you probably received the material, and they are amongst the reasons why you came out tonight, but just to give you a brief bio on each of the panelists. Paul Ramirez Jonas is an artist who's based in Brooklyn. His work was included in the 53rd Venice Biennial and the 28th São Paulo Biennial in 2010. His Key to the City, which was the title of a project he presented with Creative Time, was all over the city of New York in every borough, and it was actually also hosted here at Cabinet. It was a wonderful project. Paul also has an exhibition up right now at Alexander Gray Gallery, plug, which I encourage you all to see. Sal Randolph at the other end of the table there. She's spoken here at Cabinet before, and that's how I got to know her, because she really blew me away. She lives in New York and makes art involving gift economies and social interactions within public spaces, publishing, including something called OpSound, which you'll find on her website, which is an open exchange of copyleft music. Mm-hmm. And she has also realized two, perhaps more, biennials, titled The Biennials, right? Yes. We can talk about what that is. And they are called Free Biennials. So Sal has been involved in the process of the open call process as well, which is in a very particular way. So salrandolph.com, you will see all of her projects there. Now, Veronica Roberts in the middle here. Is the director of research for the Saul LeWitt wall drawing catalog Resonate. And she first began to work with LeWitt in 2000 when she coordinated his retrospective for the Whitney Museum. So Veronica is actually the only person here who's worked with Saul LeWitt. And she very generously came forward and you know, was very enthusiastic about the show, and we've become kind of recent colleagues based on this whole project. And that's something that I think really characterizes this particular project is, I was just talking to one of the artists, Hope Sandro, here, how it's really kind of an intersection of different art worlds that have come together. I'll just explain a bit about the conception of it and the procedures and how it came together. And then I'd like to find out exactly who in the audience is in this project, because I have a feeling a number of you might be, in fact. So basically, the premise for this was inspired by a visit to Saul LeWitt's own private collection in Chester, Connecticut. It is an incredible collection of works that he has acquired mostly through exchange, but also that he's purchased. But a lot of the works have been exchanges with his, you know, former colleagues, artists, friends, people that he knew, as well as people that he did not know, who had sent in work in admiration of his own work. So there's this whole sort of range that you could recognize as coming from conceptual, minimal, all the, you know, the canonical works. And then you have these sort of what I would call almost folkloric works or vernacular works, things that people had just given him out of sort of for gifts and out of love. So there's this lovely kind of spectrum. And I think seeing that, I saw a slideshow of the collection, and seeing that was really a testament to how he had touched so many artists in so many different ways, regardless of what his own work actually looked like. And this was kind of interesting in terms of, you know, you assume that artists influence other artists or other people stylistically or aesthetically. But in his case, it was really a question of a kind of spirit of openness, or so I gathered anyway. Then this, you know, discussion with Cabinet magazine came about, and Cabinet being the kind of sort of intellectually adventurous magazine in space, took to the project as an open call. We decided to publish an open call in their issue, and we then approached Mass MoCA about receiving the open call. Mass MoCA is currently hosting Solowitz murals that are going to be up for about another 23 more years. So they have the kind of monumental side of Solowitz's body of work, and they were quite interested in bringing in a more discursive project. So here at Cabinet, we, you know, the call that went out was really a set of guidelines for people to consider a gift for Solowitz, consider if they could exchange with him continuously, what, you know, what would they give him? And I'd like to also mention that this wasn't so much about monumentalizing or paying homage to Saul LeWitt. It was really, and my hope was that I was sort of triggering a kind of engagement with the work that he had set forward, set something in motion, you know, just picking up the, I call it entering the conversation, picking up from where he'd left off, perhaps. I really, you know, enjoyed sort of rereading the sentences on conceptual art when thinking about this project and the idea that irrational thoughts should be followed logically. This to me felt very much like an irrational thought. So with the call, sorry if I'm being a little long-winded, it's a long story, but with the call there was a month, a sort of window of time in which people could send in by email or by mail, or they could drop off any kind of object. It didn't have to be artwork per se. It could also be any kind of ephemera. It could be food, wine. It could be really any material within a particular set of guidelines, a particular scale, so that, of course, we could house it. And basically what came through was a kind of flash mob, I call it, of people from all over the world sent in by email but also by mail. All kinds of materials, and I'll talk more about that as we go through the panel tonight. So I'm really thankful to all of you who are in the project, who are here. If you could just raise your hand, if you are in the project, I'd like to see who's here. Okay, wow, very good.
Impressive.
Okay, thank you. Excellent. Also, as we go along, I mean, it'd be great to hear from you as well. If you have questions or comments or anything specifying the, you know, submission, that would be helpful. Nearly 1,000 submissions came in, so I have to say that it was a real challenge to register, photograph. We're creating a newspaper publication, so it's it was quite an enormous task on both the part of Cabinet and Mass MoCA. So I hope that we, you know, received everything in its totality, given that there was a lot of anecdotal information, a lot of backstories, a lot of thank you notes, a very interesting kind of assortment of engagement with the call itself. So like I said, I'll continue with some of those stories, but I think it would be a good idea to move on to Veronica Roberts. And what we're going to do here is just talk about, you know, pose questions to one another and give a sense of, number one, how this particular project might have triggered any one of our particular interest or research. I know Veronica in particular has had direct kind of research and engagement not only with Saul LeWitt but also with his assistants, and that's kind of an area that I think we'd all be interested to hear more about as well. The relationships between them, the community that is formed around them.
Well, and probably most people in the room know a little bit about how his
whose drawings were made and how they worked, but maybe not everybody.
Right,
so.
Right.
Yeah, that would be a good basic kind of LeWitt 101.
Actually, when I started working with Saul, I have to admit I knew his name. I knew I had read paragraphs on conceptual art, but I really didn't know the work very well since I was fresh out of undergrad, and it doesn't reproduce very well. As many of you know, pencil on wall is not the easiest thing to reproduce. So I was bringing myself up to speed and learning about his work, and I think based on just some of the books, I had this conception that conceptual art and his work might be quite dry and cerebral, and maybe I hadn't really lucked out being assigned to the show, and obviously how wrong I was. I shouldn't be saying this, but like every bank password, every computer password I've ever had in my entire life has always had his name in it ever since I met him. You know, it's just like he's part of my like DNA every minute of my life pretty much, because I found not only the work to be so extraordinarily rich, and rewarding, but the person himself to be very much the same. And it's funny because there's this paradox of Saul. He did not, his work was very resolutely non-referential, not about biography, not about the outside world. And yet I feel like there's this generosity of spirit that is in the work, and so much is a part of who he was. And part of that's the way he makes the work, which is what you were talking about, Sal, in that he, you know, he made the very first wall drawing he did in 1968 at Paula Cooper's gallery, at a show curated by Lucy Lepard, and he did that one directly on the wall himself. But even from the very next wall drawing that he did in LA, he was already having art students, people from CalArts primarily at that time, helping him, because he quickly realized that he didn't need to do all the work himself. It was very much based on concepts and instructions and rules, and it was not about his hand. I mean, he was not interested in that sort of authoritative signature mark that, you know, you have in a Jackson Pollock. That was not what interested him. And so it was really the idea that interested him that was most important. And so quick... I mean, it was a brilliant approach, because it allowed him to make almost 1,300, you know, wall drawings in his life in a way that he would never have been able to do if he made them all himself and was flying all over the world. But it also opened up this incredible community of people who've worked for him over the years. And my job at the Whitney was to hire the young artists who would work in tandem with this core group of people who had worked with Saul for all these years. I mean, the stories that I'd get to hear and the relationships over years and years. Joe Watanabe, who made a lot of his prints, was a master printmaker, worked closely with him. You know, I'd hear about how like Joe needed a car and Saul needed a table, and next thing you knew, like he had Saul's old car, and you know, he gave Saul a table. I mean, these kinds of exchanges, and then hearing about the LeWitt collection, of course, that more than 3,000 works. I remember meeting Fred Tomaselli and him telling me how amazing it was when he was a young artist and he had heard that Saul traded, and he, you know, sent Saul a work, and lo and behold, he got one in exchange. So hearing these stories was really remarkable. And when I was at the Whitney, watching the wall drawings unfold at the very end of the project, another thing that Saul did at the very end of the project, and I think he's done this since his retrospective at MoMA in 1978, he made a work of art for every single person who worked on the show. And I remember he asked me, he called me on the phone. He'd never emailed. I'm sure his life would have been much crazier if he was on email. But I remember he called me and he said, "Veronica, I need you. I have a very important job for you." I said, "Oh, okay, what is it?" And he said, "I need you to write a list of every person who has helped on the show. I want you," and he said, "it's very important that you include interns. It's very important that you include anyone who had any role in this. And it's a really important task." And I said, "Okay." And so I, you know, set about making this list. It was 65 people in the end at the Whitney who had been involved. And the next thing I knew, he was in, you know, my boss's office for a couple of hours inscribing 65 prints by name to every single person, which I then had to distribute because he did not want to be thanked in person. I then had to distribute I spent an entire day walking around the building handing people these prints, and just people being overwhelmed that he would do something so kind. And I've, you know, subsequently learned he's done this a lot. He has done this, you know, many times, that kind of generosity and kindness. So, and just a few other interesting anecdotes, and then I'll say why I also think this is important to the work. I found out after at the Mass Mocha show, a number of the people who were on the crew fell in love with one another. There were like three or four different romances, which you certainly won't read about in the catalog that accompanies the show, but just this sort of communal bringing together of people. And once you were in Saul's life, you really, you know, he didn't let you go. You know, if you were a friend, he would write you postcards. He would, you know, he wrote me postcards in grad school asking about my grandparents. You know, that's the kind of person that he was. And even though the work is so resolutely non-referential, I do think there's a way in which that generosity and that act of communal work to make the wall drawings and the sort of is very much a part of his work. And later, I'd love to talk about the ways in which I think that kind of that generosity is quite subversive. I think it's interesting the way it is subversive. But one last thing I wanted to say, and then I'll I have a question for Paul, but one last thing I wanted to say is how this all began, this generosity, because I've been doing a lot of interesting research on his wall drawings and his career, and Regine has mentioned this, I think, before too, but, you know, he started out when he lived in New York, he started out as a basically a night receptionist at MoMA, and it was a God, what an amazing time it would have been to work at MoMA. Not at all like when I was there, but in 1960, a lot of the most important friendships that he made at MoMA, and they were with people who were artists who were working essentially as security guards. So that's where he met Robert Ryman, who was a security guard there probably the longest. MoMA let him use like essentially Titus Auditorium to like practice the saxophone because his apartment was so small, and he was still like thinking he'd be a jazz musician at that point. So he met Robert Ryman, Dan Flavin, who he said never stopped talking, but he credited Flavin. He said he never would shut up. Ryman said virtually nothing, but Flavin was always talking. But he got so much from Flavin, and he always really credited Flavin for, you know, all these lunchtime conversations. And Robert Mangold worked there, who's probably the person who he really remained the most close to. I think they talked about baseball a lot in addition to art. And Lucy Lepard was in the library, married to Ryman. I mean, the connections, the intersections between all these people, and they were trading work with each other. So some of the earliest work is, you know, with Ryman and Mangold, and eventually Eva Hesse, which is an area I'm really interested in, is the friendship with Hesse. It's almost like a sub-theme of the show, too. There's a lot of work that it references that friendship. So I also think it's, you know, he's both a fascinating person, but it was also an interesting time in the art world and the way that people were meeting one another. But,
can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt, but since you're working on the catalog Raisonné and you're closer to the kind of, let's say, chronicling of, you know, the history of the making of, let's say, of the works and so on, can you hear me okay? This feels like it's not on. How do you account for what is normally considered a very sentimental or anecdotal kind of bit of information? I mean, I was really aware of how soulful the response was to this exhibition, and I thought, well, you know, since, you know, Saul recently passed, and of course there is a lot of sentiment, and how is that going to register in posterity? And, you know, how is art history, I hate to pose this to you like you're, you know, the canon with the big C, but really is a question like, how is it going to sort of register in historical terms, or with, you know, that there is a risk of being sort of almost too personal about it, but that's just the way that art history kind of rejects that kind of, you know, personal anecdotal information. So I wonder, I mean, has there been discussions on your end about how to treat that kind of information, or is...
Yeah, I think my impression just from knowing Saul, he was deeply uncomfortable when people thought he could somehow stand in for the work, or if they put him sort of on a pedestal,
right.
And, you know, I don't think, I mean, he was pretty shy, and kind of when people would ask for his photo, that was another thing. He just really wanted to distance sort of the man and the work, because when people would ask for his photo, I remember seeing a catalog where all these artists had contributed a photo of themselves, and Saul contributed one of his dog, Lila. But I don't think I think he didn't want to be sort of, you know, totally glorified or put on a pedestal. He could be but I also think that he was interested in, I think he, his art was enriched by that community that he was part of, and that was his code of conduct. It was his way of living. That's, you know, that's what sustained him. And and I do think it comes into the work in interesting ways. I mean, I don't know how exactly to answer your question, but, you know, I mean, one of the things I'm really interested in, and this isn't the case for every exchange, but, you know, he and Hesse, who are artists that are so different in many ways, they gave each other a lot of work and had such an important friendship. There's this amazing letter that Saul wrote that you can hear that some musicians put to song in the show. And I really think she impacted his work and vice versa. I mean, that the work, that friendship is crucial to understanding their work, the mm-hmm. just from the not straight line that he starts using when after Hesse died in 1970, he immediately makes this wall drawing in homage to her, but it's not like this isolated tribute. It becomes this not straight line that he does in almost 100 wall drawings and so many works on paper, I couldn't even count them. And this notion of art being different every time it's made is something he really credits. I mean, Hesse is not the one who originated, but he really credits his interest in this idea of art being different every time it's made, the wall drawing being different every time it's made. Mm. He really credits that to her. So I think there are ways that these friendships and these connections are in the work too. But it's not like Saul's politics are somehow, you know, his literal politics are somehow manifested in the work. Or his emotional state of being is somehow directly registered, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of an interesting quandary.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I didn't want to divert you from what you were going to say.
No, I was going to ask. I was just going to ask Paul a question, which I didn't get a chance to get my key here to Cabinet, but did manage to do a lot of other Key to the City stops. And I know that gifting has been really an important part of your work. And I'm kind of interested in the ways that your work has engendered gifting and exchanges, and how what's been the motivation for that, and how you arrived at that, and maybe if you can also talk a tiny bit about Key to the City, just because so that people understand what that, for those of you who didn't participate in it, what that was about too.
I'll give the briefest summary I can of Key to the City and move on from there. But
it's hard to do.
But just Key to the City just had two goals. There's the Key to the City, which is an honor that is bestowed on non-citizens, right? And it's very old. It comes from when cities were walled and they had gates. And then non-citizens could be given the key to the city. They were going to be trusted access to the city. And I wanted to do two things. Because it has become a medal that has no real function, I wanted to make it bring it down from that pedestal so it would be real, so it would open real places. So the first thing, the first challenge was to change 24 locks around the city so they could be opened by one key, the key to the city. So that's that. And that created like a little portrait of the city. It was private spaces, public spaces, hard to find, popular, etc. But the second aspect was to convince the mayor to devolve his power. So it wouldn't just be the mayor's office that could decide who deserved the key to the city, but that any of us could go and award this award to whomever we saw fit. And so then people go to Times Square, and a total of 18,000 people came. And you had to bring the person you wanted to bestow the key on, and we provided you with everything you wanted needed for the ceremony. We provided you with a key, a guide to, and ledgers, and words. Words so you could have a ceremony and go through a ritual. And that's important, I think, in relation of Saul LeWitt and this show, which is that I think that, you know, people, I mean, it's sort of the debate of human nature, if people are good or bad. mm-hmm. But what's interesting about generosity is that you kind of need a very tight structure for it to come forth. I mean, I think we're very skeptical and apathetic times. And in Key to the City, I knew that to make it work from previous works and previous experiences, it's like the structure, it's like conceptual art. Like it has to be a set of instructions that is quite strict. And I think of it as a game. Like a good game has very strict rules, but no clear outcome. If the outcome is clear, then, you know, whatever. It's not a good game. If the rules are not clear, it's also not a good game. And I feel like this show, right, is like you say, it's not curated, but what's different is you decided that your concentration is not going to be on choosing the outcome, but making very strict rules. And then I feel like when there's very strict rules, like in the wall drawings or the show or Key to the City, and you allow people to enter those rules, then, you know, in a very paradoxical way, that can be very generous, because then people, maybe people's better instincts can come forth if the rules are well made.
That's interesting also, that rules can be liberating then in a way too, like both generous, but I think there's a way that rules can be, having these set parameters, as you said, where you don't know the outcome, but somehow it can be liberating and open up different sort of opportunities. I think that's interesting.
Yeah, I don't even know if rules are the right word, but it's like
guidelines or something.
Well, like you need to create a space and then leave that space empty for people.
Yeah.
That's generous. And then there's kind of trust that, you know, that 100 years from now, people are going to follow the instructions to make a wall drawing, and they're not going to be like, well, you know, we don't have pencils anymore. So.
Right.
Yeah, that's...
And it was interesting how many works in the show picked up on the rules and instructions, and but also picked up on the fact that even though he was working with rules and instructions, picked up on the playful aspect. You know, just because you have guidelines or parameters that you set up, they can still be very playful and or irrational, completely irrational. So there's like I just discovered a work on my way to the restroom that it had to do with hopscotching, and it was rules for the hopscotchers, and I hadn't seen that one before, and it's kind of wonderful, these, you know, hopscotch for Saul LeWitt. Rules to follow.
It's also funny because I was thinking on our when we were getting ready about this idea that gifts are free, but that there's like two meanings to the word free. It means no money, right? Like we think, oh, it's a gift, it's free, but there's also the deeper meaning of freedom, in that not all gifts engender freedom, but all gifts are free. Well, actually, not all gifts are free, but. But I was just trying to think of that play of like when exactly does a gift create freedom, and it's like, does this show create freedom? It's like, well, yes, because you know, then you're like, I don't know. It's like, at least for me, it was like, oh, I don't need to send an art. I don't know. I'm free to do whatever I want, which is actually being an artist not true most of the time, because you know, you're an artist. You have your work. You make your work. You know, you're not free to stray from your work. But if you're making a present for someone who's passed away, then or actually just making a present gives you freedom as an artist. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's not your work. You're making a present. Oh, cool.
Exactly.
But all of your work is presents, practically. Well, or free.
It's true.
That's what it is.
It's about the free is in your work, exactly. Yeah. I
push the mic. Yeah, sorry.
Thank you. Use it very definitively.
Yeah, I use the word free a lot, and I guess partly because it has both of those connotations. But I started working with the gift when I was making sculpture, and I lived in this small town, and I was showing my work every year, and that was all, you know, it was all going really well, except I found that there was a kind of a what I now think of as the thorn in the rose, which is that I would have a show, I would have an opening, everybody would come. It was a lot like this. It was there was a feeling of community. It was friendly. People were looking at the work, but even as I was, you know, drinking my glass of wine or whatever it was and chatting with my friends, you could see what was happening around the room as people were looking at the art. And when you make visual art, stuff that's up on a wall, especially when people look at it, they have this habitual posture and manner of approaching it, which is they look for a second or two or three if you're really lucky, and then they nod a little bit sometimes, and then they stroll onward. There's a pause, there's another look and a stroll and a pause, and this is people liking the work. this was the best you could do, and I found myself really unsatisfied with that moment of encounter, and I began a long series of different experiments and investigations about how to do something to get something more back from that moment. And I won't detail all of them, but one of them, the one that was sort of my originary myth story for me, was I had a big installation of photographs, and that also, you know, went just fine. It got reviews and people bought some, but in the back of the room, I had, as one of these experiments, set up a free raffle. And I made these like little photo snow globes that were not very serious. And you could enter as many times as you want. And so here was the main show, and people were looking at it as if it was art. And then here was this small little table with these this free raffle, and there was a sudden like frenzy. So suddenly people were like, they ran out of the little cards to enter. They were tearing up the checklists from the exhibition. They were stuffing the ballot. They were excited. They were greedy. They were mad at me. They couldn't buy these things, and these are things that I swear they would not have wanted to buy. So suddenly there was something really happening that I could see. And I had tried selling things very, very, very cheaply. As I'd gone down to 10 cents. So, and that did nothing. And free did this huge thing. So I became really interested in what this free was and why it had so much balled up energy in it. It was almost like feeling like he'd split the atom. So from that point on, I began a long series of different kinds of projects and investigations that all are, you know, just different ways of kind of cracking this or looking at this. What is that energy? It's partly social and it's partly psychological. So I could see a whole range of emotions that I never got to see before in relation to my work. Fear, anxiety, anger, excitement, generosity, exuberance, all kinds of feelings. And then also it created these social bonds and social spaces. So I began to sort of read about the gift and read about why the gift works. And there's some great books one could recommend about them. Lewis Hyde's book, The Gift, is sort of the classic that a lot of artists find their way into this material with. And then that led me to Marcel Mauss, who's an anthropologist. And he wrote a very classic book about the gift. And his main insight, which I think, you know, relates to this show, is that the gift seems to create an obligation to return. And how does that work? What is that? Why do we want to return a gift? That was his big question. And I think, you know, in this kind of show, we see Saul Lewitt's work as you're seeing it as a kind of a gift to the world. Like, it's already out there. Right. We're already, I mean, I've been influenced by his work sort of forever. I've always been super interested in instructions as a kind of generator of artworks. And he's definitely a part of that. I could have put, I don't know, almost tons of different projects of mine connected up with his work in different ways that I could have put into this show sort of in a plausible way, different book projects, different instructional projects, different things involving grids, you know, like pretty much. And yet I would say if you looked at my work as a whole, it would look nothing like his. And I think it probably that's true if you took any of the artists in this show and kind of expanded out what their own, if we gave each of them solo shows and, you know, and really talked about what their interests were, you'd see intersections and inspirations, but you'd see a body of work that looked very different. So that, I think, is one of the places that I'm interested in about this show, how people respond to, I mean, Lewis Hyde sees it this way, that art is a kind of a gift anyway, how people want to return that gift, want to give something back, want to write to him, like the way you do kind of want to write to somebody who's really inspired you. Yeah, I'm curious to know if either of you two know what he gave back when he gave back things when people sent him stuff.
Well, he made either prints or gouaches. They were usually of a certain size. I mean, you know, they were gift size.
So did he have a special body of work that he made mainly for this purpose?
I don't think it was a special body of work. He loved making gouaches. He made lots and lots of gouaches, and so I don't think it was by no means just for, you know, just for that purpose. But I think, you know, he saved I don't know of him giving wall drawings to people who wrote him a letter, I don't know the full range, but it does seem like he loved works on paper and making gouaches. And was a really passionate printmaker too, which makes sense too when you think about printmaking. And it's you know, he helped found Printed Matter with Lucy Lepard and others, and you know that. So I think that yeah, it's interesting to think about that, but not one specific kind of work.
It's interesting that you worry about his legacy into the future, because I've been pondering, it's like, oh no, it's in the work, you know. In the future, when they take out the wall drawing from the file cabinet, it has to be reshown again, then someone has to make it, and then they'll go home and they're like, whatever, rocket, and then they'll say, oh, I made a solid wit and I experienced these things, and like somehow, but then I'm like, maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe it's enough that he had an incredibly ethical life, and then he had, he was a role model who, you know, like I only met him once briefly in a parking lot, you know, and but I know he affected some of my closest friends. So like an interesting thing about art is that there's a transmission. It's funny because I'm almost advocating that Solowit will always have a legacy among artists,
yeah,
that is transmitted through role modeling and through mentoring. And
right.
And so maybe it's not for art history, but maybe it's for that mini art history of artists who look at other artists who say, well, yeah, who do I want to be like? And even though someone who, like myself, who didn't know him has been affected by that, second generation, meaning like not firsthand, so maybe it's okay. I mean, I feel like 95% of the things that are the most wonderful about art are lost anyways, you know. Right, like in the end we get like an object in some collection, if the artist is lucky, and that gets like taken out every couple decades, if they're even more lucky, and all the things surrounding it don't necessarily survive, and maybe that's okay.
Well, it's kind of like lives of the artists, right? I mean, I was thinking about how... This is like what we're talking about is Solowit culture. there's a culture around that has grown virally that may or may not have anything to do with Sol doing something directly to this or that person, or you know. So it's kind of this interesting subculture, maybe even. And you know, you were just telling me how some of the artists in the show were former students of yours, and that just led me to think, well, there's a Paul Ramirez Jonas culture out there that you may not know about yet, but it's
big enough to make yogurt.
Yeah. There's definitely a bad guy's culture out there. But, sorry,
there's
joke.
Also there. I also noticed in when I was at Mass MoCA in particular, but in both rooms, there's a participatory art culture, or there's an open call culture. So if I did a biennial in 2002, I could actually see some of the same people at Mass MoCA. So Herbert Friedel did this, I thought, very beautiful little green gouache. For the show, but in Free Biennial he was actually in Free Manifesto, which was a slightly different version of it in Germany. But he did a stack of plastic bags you could take away that said art cannot be bought, art cannot be sold. So he did a kind of and they were made in particular as a response to the Frankfurt Art Fair, which was going on at the same time. So, but it's fun, and Jody Zellin was in both projects, or Matthew Rose was in both projects. It was kind of great to see people whose work that I have come to know through their interest in responding to these communities of participation. And these are all people who, you know, show in galleries and have otherwise serious careers or whatever. It's not that they're existing completely outside the art world, but for some people, I think, are interested in this process of finding their way into a community of interest. And you know, today that's our community of interest is Solowit, right?
Well, it's super interesting to me how artists always get in trouble, because it's such a fine, what I admire about Solowit, which I don't know exactly how it happens, but you know, like an artist makes something really simple and then people say like, I could do that, and that's a negative, but it's such a fine line when someone looks at a work of art and says, I could do that, and then it's a positive. And I feel like it's interesting that Solowit's work, I've never heard someone say like, well, I could do that. It's like actually people are excited that they could do that. And
he gets to it before they say that.
Right, but it's funny because in the culture of instructables, it's all love. It's all like, I could do that, you know, and you download it, and then you do it, and then exactly what you thought was going to happen happens, and then you're super excited. Right, it's like a ritual. But it's funny that with art, it doesn't quite happen. It's interesting, it does happen with Felix Gonzalez Torres is another artist like that. Like people are like, and I go to many, many homes and there's two clocks. You know, and people are not upset. They're like excited that they can make the two clocks or or they put the poster up on the wall.
Yeah. I'm always surprised more people don't make their own Solowit wall drawings because the instructions are very clear and actually quite simple. And I've always meant to make one or install their own Dan Flavins. I mean, there's no...
It's so much harder than you think, though. Oh, my gosh. Some of them are deceptively simple. I mean, I remember wanting to sort of participate during the Whitney show, and basically I was given a rag and got to do, like, one layer of ink wash of, like, 72 layers of ink wash and this one remote triangle in the corner because I realized watching how hard some of them are. I mean, some of them you could do it. You know, Dorothy Vogel did one herself in her bathroom. But, you know, it's not – they're not as easy as you think, and no wonder he made them simple. I mean, people think, oh, he must have been, like, very mathematical, too, but he really wasn't that mathematical. But, like, figuring out how to lay out the grid perfectly on a wall, you realize that architecture is strange, it is irregular, you know, you're imposing. It's interesting. He says, you know, the idea is the machine that makes the work of art, and it's on these Mass MoCA T-shirts, and it's become sort of part of his sort of manifesto, and that the execution is a perfunctory affair. But all you have to do is talk to people who've actually made them, and the execution is not a perfunctory affair. And all these questions come up, and, I mean, that's one of the reasons we're doing the wall drawing catalog resume. There's going to be, like, a cookbook that explains all the different ways you know, how you apply the ink, and it looks simple, but it's not really.
Yeah, well, that leads me to the next question I was going to ask you about that sort of level of expertise and how do you find that and, you know, how were people vetted? I don't know if this is going to be, you know, treated in the catalog resume, but it's such interesting information because it is a particular kind of artist that could execute.
Yeah, and I think it has to do also, I remember when we were hiring people that we it had a lot to do with also seeing if someone could be a good team player because inevitably there are many hands working on these things. And if you have too much ego, it becomes a problem. So it wasn't always just skill that you were looking for, but really kind of an ethos almost in a way of working and working with other people. But, I mean, most of the people that he's worked with were students, you know, artists, but not always, you know, there were, you know, a wide range. A lot of, I'm sort of interested in a lot of the young artists who were students when he worked with them and then went on to sort of become pretty well established in their own right. I mean, the list is much longer than you'd think. Adrian Piper, if you know Saul, you might know that he had a close friendship with Adrian Piper, lived in the same building. You know, Mel Bochner did one, but people like Christian Marclay and Daniel Buren, Andre Cadere. I mean, there's just a long list and a lot of young artists who I think are still making their way and Jim Welling, the photographer. I mean, it's just this long list of I'm kind of interested in that too. But a lot of whom, I think Christian Marclay must have been 12 when he did it because it just, a lot of them were pretty young, but.
One of the things I was struck by in what you were saying, Regine, is the difficulty of receiving. Mm-hmm. That we think of the gift as being the hard part, but actually getting a thousand responses to the show is a problem. And in a way, I think one of the things that curators cure us of is the immense abundance of art, of the desire and the exuberance of the desire to make art that's all around. So I'm curious if you have any thoughts about the difficulty of receiving.
Well, I was going to bring it up when you were talking about, you know, gift giving and so on earlier on and in your projects as well, is that, you know, there's a lot to be said in the literature that you just mentioned. There's a lot that is about the act of receiving and the sort of mode you have to be in order to do that. I don't know. I don't want to sound so, you know, mystical about it, but there's something actually in mysticism about it too, and which I'm not going to go into right now. But there is definitely a kind of practice in and of itself that has to do with, you know, age-old rituals about receiving and giving. And I just felt that this, you know, I really learned through this project because one of the main things I learned is the responsibility, first of all, as, you know, curator, as, I don't know, receiving on behalf of Saul LeWitt. I mean, it was very overwhelming for me to receive letters to Saul LeWitt by people who wrote personally to him as if he had been alive. And I'm thinking, wow, we're going to put this on display, and this is, you know, this felt like, this is the part that I thought was a bit voodoo when I made the list of topics to be covered in this talk, because, you know, the kind of subversive, as you brought up, you know, this is something you don't do usually, and was quite on the side of being strange. There was also a wisdom tooth that somebody sent that was definitely on the side of, you know, it freaked me out a little bit. but, you know, I was very happy about all of that. Yeah, how do you receive somebody's wisdom tooth, you know, and then put it in a show and all of that? So it was, you know, I'm still thinking about it. I'm still processing it.
What's interesting about that is that we always think of someone who's generous as someone who gives, but it takes a particular frame of mind to be generous as the person who accepts anything. And it's interesting that if you think of the museum, we can think of, oh, the museum is very generous. They take works of art and make sure that at perpetuity they give it back to the public. But now let's try to imagine a museum that is generous in the other direction. They'll accept anything people send them. It's like the structures of art are already built towards one kind of generosity, which is to give, give, give. So it's like, it's not so hard for Felix Gonzalez Torres to make a work that can take advantage of that. But it's really hard to imagine an art structure like Saul LeWitt did. It's like, oh, we're going to have a studio that accepts any present, or we're going to have an exhibition that accepts anything for the show, or we're going to have a museum that takes everything you send them into the collection. It's like they say gifts, there was that show that I was in at Apex Art called Gifts Go in One Direction.
Right.
But really, in a more higher level of generosity, that I know must be really hard to attain. Gifts probably go in both directions. Mm-hmm. And that's what's interesting. Just to think of like this artist who was just willing to accept anything that was sent to him and how unusual that is.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious to hear a little about your coin projects. Like, so you've made coins that, and I don't know very much about them, but that you use to give to people in response to things they've given you? How does that work? What do you do?
This started out of jealousy. My wife has something she calls the gift drawer. And whenever she's going to go do a show, she just opens the gift drawer and puts a bunch of things in. These are things that she knows, like installers, curators. She's going to need a lot of gifts. And then I think, oh, I don't know. But then I thought, oh, what's interesting is, like, you know, I go to a restaurant, I get good service, I tip, you know. But when you are an artist and you do a show, it's like you tip the curator or the instructor. I realized there's no currency for this. So I minted a coin that then I stuff into, it's better because it takes very little room in the suitcase. And then, but it's interesting. I never thought of it as an artwork. I just think it's this thing I do to thank people. And then for Key to the City, what's interesting is I thought, oh my God, this project, there were about 240. I didn't know this. I made the list of people I had to thank. It was really long. And I thought, how am I going to thank them? And it's that same thing that you're as an artist when you realize, well, really, Lauterman Eucalys talks about this brilliantly in this interview where she talks about, like, we imagined the Jackson Pollock, the genius painting, and he made the painting. But then maybe you think, like, but who cooked the lunch? And who cleaned the studio? And you can go down that pyramid that supports this one life that makes this painting. So I was just trying to think of that pyramid that supports an artist and how do you thank them. And there's really, you know, at the opening dinner, you always have to be, okay, you get to invite three people. And then you have to be like, okay, who are the three people I'm going to invite? You can never invite enough people for it. So for Key to the City, I made a medal because I was like, oh, they need to get more than a coin this time. So I contacted the military mint that makes medals, and then I had like a medal minted for everyone who helped in the project. And I just thought, that's part of the invisible.
I survived.
What did it say?
It said monument maker.
Oh, that's great.
Well, it's funny, the key, I mean, I have one of the keys, and it's on my keychain, and my keychain already has too many keys on it. But I keep that key, even though now it doesn't,
I think, open any. Maybe it does. Open. It does still open the cabinet. I love the cabinet. Cabinet one makes these little great little bubbles if you don't have a key. Yeah. It's really very funny.
It starts to accrue its own value after the fact as well, just like the Felix Gonzalez Torres does.
But it makes me feel a little bit like I do have not a full key to the whole city, but some kind of, like, it gives me some kind of, like, connection to the city as well as to you.
Hmm. Oh, well, that's what you said to me, because I was going to ask you about your book project in particular, which is that I like the non-authorship, that there's all these books you've made, and they're all over. You don't even know where they are. Mm. You don't know who's looking at them.
Can you describe it?
Yeah, can you describe that project?
Sure. This was a project called Free Words, and it was really the first, you know, after that moment that I described, I did a number of smaller experiments, but this was the first time I'd sort of figured out how to really integrate this idea of the gift into an actual work of art. And the fantasy that I had, I'd spent a lot of time in libraries in the time leading up to that, and I always had this fantasy as I was walking through the stacks, not writing what I was supposed to be writing, that I would find some book that was left there just for me. And so I had this idea of infiltrating a book into the world that was left there for people to find. And one of the first problems was what to put in it, because almost any content I could think of seemed too specific, like it wouldn't feel like it was for you. And so what I ended up with was I put in a list of words that I'd been accumulating over about 10 years as part of sort of the offshoot of my practice as a poet. So it was something, it was a text that was never meant to be read. It was never meant to be contiguous. It was never, I tried to print it in a way that didn't make you feel you had to start at the beginning and move through the book in a normal way, that you could just kind of open it up and use it somehow mentally or physically for any purpose. And in fact, people did. I mean, some woman told me she was teaching her kid to read from it, although I had to warn her there were naughty bits ahead. but, you know, people made collages from it and cut it up and made poems from it, did all kinds of sort of playful physical things with copies of it. But for me, what really happened with that project that was such a surprise, and this, I think, is to me a hallmark of working with gifts and social artworks in general, is I thought it was all about that moment when a person might find it. And that was the, and there they were in a bookstore, most of them were in bookstores and libraries, and they had to decide whether to keep it for themselves or to leave it there, whether they were really allowed to take it away, even though it said it was free. And that was like, that was the whole thing. But what actually happened is, I mean, that did happen a little bit, but somebody found the book who was part of a social network online. And I had put a little thing on the website that said you could distribute the book if you wanted to, and I'd send you some copies. And I just figured, you know, out of 1,000 copies that went out in that first batch, maybe, you know, 100 people max would visit the website, and of those, 2 might be interested in distributing books. But what happened is this woman sent the story of the book out on her social network, and suddenly there were a gazillion people who wanted to distribute books who'd never seen it. So to me, suddenly it turned into a completely different kind of work and a completely different kind of project, which was all about the interconnections of people online and the desire of people. Like, there were all these, like, kids in little towns who were writing to me, teenagers who felt like they were the only, I couldn't use their name because they were the only, even their last name, because they were the only weird kid in the town, so everyone would know it was them if I even put the town on the website. But there were all different, so it became, it started out as something that seemed like this small intimate moment of the gift and became the part of the gift which is creating a kind of social network.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because something I've learned slowly, which is that I'm not really interested in giving things away, but I'm interested in making something that other people can give away.
Yes,
and
right.
That's that's the tricky thing where because there's it's otherwise it's facile participation, like, you know, like free mints, you know. But but what you want someone to take the mint and go give it to someone else.
That's called passing the
fork. Yeah, but that's where I think really rules are important, because it's like, it's almost like you need to create that structure to allow something to happen. But it's not enough. That's the thing about free. It's like, One thing is to give things away for free, and the other one thing is to try to create a space for a kind of freedom. And they overlap, but not exactly.
That's interesting that you said what you just said. It was making me think about how a true gift is when nothing is really expected in return. And I'm thinking about how much I hate baby showers and that moment when people open presents in front of you. Like, it's just the most awful, uncomfortable, awful ritual in our. And I think that one of the things that's so wonderful, I mean, Saul was often giving works, but sending them in the mail. He wasn't like sitting around bestowing them either. And I think it can be a very uncomfortable to have to, I mean, there's a true gift is really worse. Nothing is necessary, needs to be reciprocated, you know. But I think that gifts have this way of creating energy, and not to sound mystical again on all of us, but you know, I guess one of the things that's so wonderful about them is not a tit for tat exchange, but just that sort of possibility and that act of generosity and what it sort of stands for. I don't know. I think it's more interesting in that way than any kind of literal tit for tat kind of exchange, which can be dreadfully awkward.
Well, I mean, just to be clear, he did engage in both, because often he gave work to friends and colleagues who were in need. Maybe they were going to be evicted, or they really needed, you know, they had a like financial crisis of some kind, and he would actually give like a major work to get them out of that financial crisis. So there was there's a number of stories that have come out of, you know, exchange, this project as well, that are related to, oh, you know, he bailed me out, like that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then there's the straight literal exchanges, which I venture to say is part of his practice in a way, because it almost feels like at that level, it's, yes, generosity is maybe driving it, but there's also the idea that he's honoring the art-making process. And if somebody made him something, he was going to make something back.
Yep.
And that was, you know, not as sentimentalized, but much more about just mind-to-mind meld, you know, a form of communication, a way of just sort of honoring the art-making process. It's so basic.
Yeah, but that's the inherent beauty of art, I think, is that it is a commodity that's for sale, but you don't need to. I don't really feel that the person who owns a work of art has something better than what I get when I experience the work of art. So as long as I get to see the work of art from time to time,
you can own it as well.
Well, I don't have to own it too. Yeah. So that's what's. It's funny. It's like we go to commercial gallery. You know, it's like when I go to a store and I can't afford it. It's like, you know, I don't go to the Apple store just to look at the iPads. Like, it's just as good as having one, you know. It's like, but I do go to galleries and look at art, and I don't feel bad that I.
You feel satiated in a way.
Yeah, I feel satiated. I mean, there's very few things in art that I feel like, I wish I had, you know, $85,000 right now.
Yeah, I think this would be a great time to open it up. Does anybody have any questions, comments?
We're very generous. We have wireless mics.
Oh, yes, we... Yes. Yeah. Yes. Okay. Let's see. Everybody's...
If you're in front, then you... I'll explain why we have eggs on the table.
I should mention that.
Yeah, thanks so much to all of you. I was really interested in something that was mentioned in passing, which is the ritualistic aspect of gift giving. And you mentioned some of the classic literature on gifts. And I was struck by what you said about the idea of, say, gifts being removed from the realm of value or financial value, true gifts being given with the expectation of nothing in return and removed from the realm of tit for tat. And one of the most interesting gift-giving rituals that I'm aware of is the potlatch, which is a form of competitive gift-giving. And I'm wondering if you have encountered that in terms of curating the show here, the show at Mass MoCA, your own artistic practice in terms of working with the concept of gifts, and how that might intersect or refract some of what we've said tonight about what it means to give and receive.
I don't know why I'm taking this. So the potlatch is something that takes place in the tribes of the Northwest Americas, and I don't think it so much happens anymore. But it's a kind of It's something similar happens in other cultures where you give a giant feast, and as part of that, you give away a huge amount of stuff to the point where it's sometimes destructive or self-destructive. Sometimes stuff is actually destroyed as part of the potlatch. Or it makes me think of that group KLF who burned $1 million. Is a kind of a pot. So the potlatch has this element of sacrifice too, and of forcing this competitive aspect you were talking about is this thing that the obligation to return is actually heightened in these societies. So sometimes if you give a huge amount, it's like a challenge to the next guy. Can you give as much? Can you give more? And if you can't give more, you can be kind of socially and financially ruined. So it has something of an edge to it. So I think this would be more like a potlatch if we could say the most, somehow we were evaluating the works, the most valuable works of art got the best spots, or all of this work was going to be destroyed afterwards, or, you know, it's not, it's actually, I think there's something about the structure of the show which is quite neutral, very Saul Lewitt-like. Like, I have a book of his autobiography, I think it's called, which is Polaroid photographs in a grid of his apartment. He appears, I think, nowhere in it. It's these neutral containers for everything he has, and you can see these boxes form that. So that in a way, we don't really know which works Regine liked and which works she didn't like. And the show is designed to respect the gesture of all the works equally, I would say, is the yeah.
No, I was going to say that. I was joking that group shows are competitive gift giving. You know, like like an artist put, you asked to be in a group show. You're like, okay, I want to be the best person in the show. You know, you might not admit it, but that's what you're thinking. You want to be the best one in the show, but you're invited to a show exchanging art with a dead artist who was very generous, and everyone can be in the show. It totally changes the equation, and then you're not in competition anymore, but you're still going to do a good job, but the good job is not measured by winning anymore. Mm-hmm. It's just, it can become quite pure, you know, sort of like when you're at the beginning of making art and everything's very pure.
Hi, I had a question about the Free Words Project and about what you do when maybe responses exceed your the participation exceeds maybe your expectations. So it's one thing to print 1,000 books and distribute them, and then you all of a sudden have this great response, which is maybe dozens, hundreds, thousands who want to distribute the book, and then you're making 30,000 books, or like, how does that work, and how do you move forward, and when the participation is so great?
You're exactly right. It crashed. seriously, you know, it's. I find it's not more expensive to make free work or work that I give away than work that ostensibly was supposed to sell. I spend as much as I can always, and so the number of books I printed ultimately was exactly as many as I could afford to print, which in the end was about 3,500 books by the time I just couldn't sort of handle the project. But there was a moment where I was getting, and I was really busy doing one of these sort of biennial things, all of these very personal responses of people wanting to participate. And I was able to keep up for a while, and then I just wasn't. And I had to, when I started up again, and I spent quite a lot of time suddenly, instead of putting books in bookstores, I was packing them up and carrying them to the post office and sending them around the world. And then there's postage too, which, you know, added up. But in the end, I would, like, once a month, I would say, I can give, you know, 10, I can take 10 new people. And the first 10 people who responded, I would take. But that didn't feel very satisfying on either end. So I think that project, the whole reason I'm probably not doing it right now is exactly the problem that you point to. If you have a solution, I want to know.
I'm sorry. Hello. All right. So I have this question, which is, in America, we're all subject to copyright law by default. So when you make a work, it's copyright you plus 70, like life plus 75 years automatically. So it's really good to talk about things being free. But the reality is you have like the estate of John Cage suing people over using the title 433. So yeah, how do you guys wrestle with that? Do you use like GPL? Do you dedicate things public domain? Do you use Creative Commons licenses? And just how do you negotiate like the legal and moral structure, I guess?
That was especially, I think, a timely question. There was the Jeff Koons, I don't know if you read about the bookends that, you know, were being sold at a store in San Francisco that happened to be in the shape of an inflatable dog balloon, as if Jeff Koons had invented the dog balloon. Like, I mean, hasn't that been around for a long time? And he was suing the store in San Francisco for these wooden bookends, claiming that they were infringing. I mean, here he is, like the master appropriations. I mean, I just thought that the irony was just never ending. So it's an excellent question.
Do you deal with copyright stuff in your work?
No,
is that one of your questions?
I guess because I guess I think of myself as an object maker, so I don't know, maybe like that doesn't seem to enter the equation. I never think that the work is being published in that way. But I do think about publishing a lot, but more like how, like right now I have a piece that I'm thinking it's about publishing in the sense of like how can people publish onto the surface of an object over and over and over again. But it's funny you would ask that because I always think, well, I'm not original. I just take forms that already exist. Yeah. And that's almost a rule I have, like not my words, not my forms. You know?
But like when I think there's a piece of yours that I saw that's the text of the very first HTML web page.
Oh, yeah.
That's hand-typed using a modified manual typewriter into clay. So obviously that's because everything, as our friend told us, and it was true, everything you scribble down is instantly copyrighted. So whether or not the person cares that they own that, they do. But do you worry about that, or do you think that that's not part of your...
I know there's someone in the audience who knows a lot about copyright. Patrick Calorin is somewhere here.
True.
Yeah, he knows everything. Everything I can say about copyright, I'm basically, he told me, and I have a terrible memory. So. But you know, but he did tell me you don't have to worry about it unless you're making money. So I'm really not so worried about it.
Well, I mean, technically you do, but actually, of course, you don't.
But actually, yeah. One thing I should say, one thing I like about keys is that you can copy them and that it's somehow built into the form. And
yeah.
The second project I did with keys, the key said, copy me on the other side.
Nice.
So you
yeah.
could just take it to a hardware store and get more.
Yeah, that's so wonderfully subversive because, of course, you know, there's so many keys that the whole
yes,
point is that you cannot copy yes. them. You know.
But, you know, it's interesting because this, I mean, I've run into this question with an exhibition of mine in the past, and I realized at that time, you know, ideas are ideas, as Saul has, you know, said in his own kind of sentences of conceptual art, that other people can just pick up on ideas, of course, and then just replicate and so on. But then when I saw the social network and Facebook and how that put that into question, that, you know, here was this sort of idea that this guy picked up on and improved upon and then got sued. And it was kind of interesting, made me think about how, you know, that blurry, yes, he's making lots of money and I wouldn't begin to call him an artist and of any kind, but it was based on the idea and the debate around whether or not that idea was ownable or not.
But you're right to point out this really, it's not a coincidence that Hyde, who wrote the book The Gift, his latest book is about copyright.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, right.
And,
yeah,
which makes perfect sense. And he talks about that, how ideas used to come from God, so no one owned them. You were just the vehicle for the idea, right? But now, you know, now we think ideas can be owned, genes can be owned, you know, water can be owned.
All kinds of things that were part of the commons are now privatized into these little domains. Yeah, and copyright used to expire, and basically now, thanks to Sonny Bono, and Disney, those are the forces, roughly speaking, never expire. So the public domain that we that, you know, has things like Middlemarch in it is is staying frozen in the past. It actually has not been moving forward in time for some time. So it doesn't ever expand. And people do have to, if they want their work to be copied, they have to do something active. Like, you can't really place it in the public domain, but you can say you are. You can try, and Creative Commons, which the person mentioned, is a way for artists to give away the rights to copy or play with their work.
Is it working? Yeah. I think the conversation is actually sort of going in the direction that I was interested in, which is this idea of the space, or the sort of space of the gift, as being in its relationship to the sort of economy that we live in, which is obviously not a gift-based economy, and it's not an art world that functions primarily on gift making, so, or gift giving. So when gifts become part of it, it's seen as sort of an anomaly or something very special and very beautiful. But what I'm also interested in is, do any of you feel that the gift is, a little bit like in Hind, is sort of an oppositional force to the system that we live in, just sort of the same way that people can be artists just by deciding to be artists? Nobody hires you to be an artist. So in some ways, that part of the equation starts off as being outside of the regular economy. But then once you start sort of entering into the sort of traditional selling world, part of the art world, of course, you get right back into it. So I'm interested in your thoughts on the relationship between the two.
I think that's a really interesting question, and probably as artists, you guys may be able to answer that differently than I would. But one of the things that... I've thought about that too. I mentioned earlier, I feel like the act of gift giving, there's something subversive about it that you mentioned. Like, there's something subversive and oppositional to the way our culture works. And I was thinking about the way that, at least for LeWitt, was like part of his, that was one of many examples of that. I mean, he didn't ever have just one dealer. He would show everywhere. Like, that seems like so promiscuous in a way. Like, he'd just show wherever, anyone who wanted to show him basically, most often could. And when I think about how I've had friends who are artists who've wanted to give me gifts, and they have to like do this dance with their dealer because, technically it needs to be sold through the gallery. But if they know you well and you were a friend and you met them before this show, then maybe they can give you I feel like there's a way in which those things are regulated. And so partly he was able to bypass, maybe the it's so different now, it's more regulated now than it was, but he was giving gifts till, 2007. But I feel like he was able to kind of work outside the system a little bit, in part because he never did have that one dealer. No one could keep track of everything for him, that he didn't have one dealer breathing down his neck, and he also could make a lot of work, so they were probably okay with it. But it's interesting to think about that, and I think you're right that there's definitely something subversive about it, and that's part of what we take pleasure in too, is sort of that subversive quality and trying to wrest free from everything just being a commodity.
It's interesting. You're right that, but that I always thought that that's. I had an art historian, what was his name? That was so long ago. When I was an undergraduate, who pointed out that the first galleries were probably in Amsterdam, in the same building, were one of the first stock exchanges. So, that's what's interesting about art. It's like it's some kind of intellectual pursuit that's also mired with commerce. And in a way, that's what makes it very real, right? Right? Because it's a bit like medicine, they save your life, but they also charge you a ton of money. It's interesting that I think that the gift is interesting as an attractor, but again, I have to repeat, like, I'm not interested in giving things away for free as much that the gift brings people in, and then maybe that allows them to be. I'm interested in people giving, not me, and only because I think it's subversive in that maybe breaks a certain kind of apathy. You were saying, like, I think I read somewhere that it's 8 to 9 seconds, the average viewing of an artwork.
Yeah.
And if you try it, it's like an eternity.
Yeah.
And
Yeah, I think that's really high.
Yeah, so I was just sort of like, how can you break the apathy of the viewer or at least how can you acknowledge you're being apathetic? Give them a choice. Do you want to be apathetic? Do you not want to be apathetic? And but well, I know that gifts can be subversive, but not in a direct look straight in the eye way. I think it has to be a kind of oblique direct.
But there's another way. And Ellen Harvey, there, asking the question, did this really wonderful project, the New York Beautification Project, where she painted small landscapes in public spaces around the city, outdoors. And they're gorgeous. And one of the things about doing things for free, one of the things about giving things away, is that you don't really have to ask permission. And you can operate in that other kind of space of freedom Ellen was also actually part of the Free Biennial and Free Manifesta, and I'm not quite sure why she responded to those open calls. And she made this incredibly great handmade chalk Persian carpet on the sidewalk in Williamsburg for the Free Biennial. And she made us she happened to be in Frankfurt for Free Manifesta. She made a chalk welcome mat for the office space that was one of my favorite things there. So maybe you can talk about the way in which the gift is subversive.
That is so not fair. You're the one sitting up there. But I know, I think that you give something, if something is free, like you said, people feel that they can own it. And we live in a society where ownership is very important to people. And for a lot of people, the idea of owning an artwork or being able to, or having an artwork that cannot be owned is both exciting and distressing. People, you know, with the beautification project, people wanted to save these paintings over graffiti sites. You know, they wanted to like chip them off the wall, or they wanted to put plexiglass over them. Or if you give things to people, it's, you know, I mean, I've also did pieces where I was doing portraits on the street for free for people. You get a very different response, and I think it has to do with people's expectations of living in an economy where owning something is very important, where you do work only because you're paid to do it, and it calls into question a lot of those expectations that people have, and so I think it's a very rich place to be, but I haven't figured out my thoughts about it either. So.
But I think your work is I've never met you till tonight, but it's a perfect example, the difference between free and gift, because I was walking to Canal Street maybe 18 years ago, I can't remember, and it was, and I saw one, I didn't know what it was, but you know, like when you're walking down, it's like Mercer, and there's like a ton of posters, and it wasn't so fancy then, and it's like, you know, it was this big. And like we looked at it, and I think it was still wet. And just and that was a moment I'll never forget, you know. But I've seen a lot of art in the last 20 years, and I don't remember any of it. Mm. So it's interesting that it's not just that it was on the street and anyone could see it, it's that the way it was delivered, that it was hand-painted, its size, that it was a real painting. And that's what made it so strong. So... I don't know. Just thank you for that.
I can't believe you saw one. I'm thrilled.
Thank you. I think we have time for maybe three more questions. You had your hand up. You had your hand up. And yeah, no.
Yes, thank you for your presentation. It's been very interesting. I have a couple of questions. When someone recopies an image, and then recopies a copy of an image, it's a conveyance of the same idea repetitively, but yet there's a degradation of the image. Do ideas that are reproduced degrade as a result of the breadth of their distribution? That's my one question. My second question is, so far the discussion here about the gift, whether it's Hyde's version or other people's, is it's a discussion taken on the high road. Is there a low road to gift giving? And if so, what might it be? Your turn.
Thanks. My thoughts are on a tangent to that, but those are great thoughts. And that would be, to me, the way I appreciate Mr. Lewitt's work is through his participation in the world. And that's the generosity, is through the many, many hands that he was able to use and help through his inspiration. He was also moving with the tools of the times. So many, you know, the machine is thought is then, you know, made real, but then it does go back in a way to him. So there's the individuality, but then he is able to reach out to the world by using, you know, many hands and making it present for many people to see, speaking of the public works.
I mean, your first question is such an enormous one about the degradation of distribution. I feel like we could spend, you know, a lot of time talking about reproduction and art in the age of mechanical reproduction and get on a bit of a tangent, but I want to punt on that one. But the second question about the low road to gift giving, I think there absolutely is a low road to gift giving. And you know, I've done it myself where you like give a gift that you really want yourself that to like a family member. And I mean, we've all done those sorts of things where you give a, you know, you're in a couple and you give a present that you really want. But I think also it goes back to the, you know, if you're expecting something in exchange, like if you're expecting, what are your expectations going into it? And maybe you can't perfectly measure that. There's not a way of like holding up a wand and it will buzz if someone's taking the low road. But I think of like, I've heard people say, you know, in oh, I gave a $200 wedding present. Why didn't I get that? It's like the expectation is then that that person has to spend $200. And I think that's where you start to get bastardized gift giving, where it's like completely lost the spirit of and become, gifts can be commodities. I mean, then it becomes a commodity, and then you just want to give an equal value commodity. So.
Wait, but. Well, there's a tradition of, and in the 90s, I think a lot of artists were thinking of a model of gift giving, which is the Trojan horse, which was the idea that an artwork would be this yummy, yummy, incredible thing that everyone would want to welcome, but it had a negative or unbelievably critical message encoded in it. And I know that many artists were thought of an artwork as this Trojan horse. It's like a false gift. It's like it seems generous, but it's really out to get you. And I don't know how successful that strategy was, but it's definitely a trope out there, which is like that you seemingly are generous just to get something in. And it's a valid form of gift giving. I mean, it did get them into the city.
Well, and the German word for gift is the same as the word for poison, and that idea also exists out there. There's cultures, I think, in India, there's a certain caste that gives away, that somebody is forced to receive. There's a caste that's also forced to receive, and it's thought to pollute them. So the higher caste is purifying themselves by ridding themselves of this impure money. We call money filthy lucre. We call it so there's an idea that having is a problem, and that actually you can become more pure by not having, and that therefore the person who you give it to gets the problem. So it's not always a good thing to receive.
Right, and there also is, I think there are ways of sort of false gifts where that don't involve a tit for tat commodity sort of thing, like I was describing with you know, a $200 present needs a $200 present in return, but even an expectation of something like you're going to treat me better, you know, you're going to be nicer to me, or I'm going to do this, you know, that even those sort of psychological or emotional expectations that can be attached to gift giving, I think can make them false too. So it just, I think there's so many different ways that we've described where it is easy for it to take the low road.
I'm curious if there's anybody here who put something in the show, if they want to tell us what it was, or, you know, if there's any chance, do we have time to do that? Maybe we don't really have time.
Well, this could be a good opportunity because I was actually going to tell you about the eggs. But Hope Sandro, who is in the audience, maybe could say a little bit about the work, because, in fact, Hope was one of the artists who submitted to the project with a work that had already been in conversation with Solowit and in really interesting ways, as part of her lifestyle, too. She really... So I think it would be great if you could just say a few words about it, Hope. Are you still here? There you are. Okay, thank you.
Oh, no, it's okay. Well, it's actually really interesting, the perspective of Paul and Sal, to hear your perspective of gift and as artists, because in some ways this whole last 5 years of my art making really started with a gift. That is the perspective I have, and that was that I met a chicken in the woods and he followed me home, and I've referred to him as a gift that just keeps giving in a certain way, because he references so much in our culture and art that I never would have known about unless he crossed my path. And as artists, we all kind of have our eyes open and our ears. I mean, that's who we are from our earliest ages, and we train ourselves to look and to just kind of go off. So I did that and changed my whole life to respond to the gift of what he gave me, which is coming into my life. And one of the things that I do is I give eggs that the hens that became his wives as gifts. So, of course, separate and apart from the topic of the conversation, I brought eggs to Veronica, who I haven't seen in quite a while, and also to Regine, because there's this whole idea of consumption in our culture as well. And this idea of what do you do with a gift? Do you eat it? Or, you know, do you save it? Do you use the gift or do you save it? Which is the same applied to our work, that we, you know, the art that we make. And what is the value? And basically what happened in the work that I was delighted to participate, to have my work be amongst my peers that respond to what Saul's life was. And certainly he was from a different generation when free meant, in the 60s, quite something different than what it means now. If you think back to free love, you know, you might have a different connotation of what he meant by giving his art free, because and Lucy and that generation. But aside from that, I happened to go to Dia Beacon when, like many of us did, when it first opened, and I was in his room, and I happened to see a little movement on one of the drawings, and it turned out, when I went very close, to be a spider. And I thought, this is really incredible, because many people think of conceptual art as very unnatural and nothing to do with daily life. And I thought that if the spider was in this drawing, it must feel some connection to his proportions and the way he drew, you know, whatever the rules were. It's not just a rule about drawing squares or lines. It must have something to do with the general life, and whether it's string theory or whatever, that we're operating in and who we are. I mean, that's a whole other thing, but it really struck a chord with me. And then last fall, when I was trying to, now I have 44 chickens, so I have to build shelters for them, and of course I want it to be art. And so I saw his show at Pace and saw a parallelogram and thought, aha, if the spider loved being on his wall drawing, my chickens might really like being in his parallelogram. And so we took the parallelogram and made it into 3 dimensions and full, you know, life size. And there are now chickens living in the parallelogram. And then we took one of his other drawings and also made it 3 dimensions. And I have chickens living in that one too. And they are chickens that like to live in trees. So they're wild, kind of. And so it's pretty spectacular to see how much they love being in a parallelogram and being in a variation of a cube. So I really appreciated that that kind of experience of seeing conceptual art really be about daily life. And I think of us as artists who are more conceptual, that many people kind of don't take the time, like Sal was saying, more than 3 seconds to look at something. And my chickens take a lot more time to look, so. And the spider too, right? Maybe, you know, more than many viewers of our work, our critics, we should add.
Thank you. I think we're going to wrap it up. It's heating up in here. I don't know if you're feeling like an oven. But if you do have any other questions, please feel free to approach us individually. And thank you again for coming. Thank you.